Headline: UN spokesperson says delivering aid to quake-hit regions in northern Syria has been hampered by a terrorist group there. A Palestinian child succumbs to injuries that he sustained during an Israeli raid on the occupied West Bank city of Jenin. And the U.S. military shoots down another unidentified flying object. Hello and welcome from our headquarters in Tehran. Thank you for joining us. My name is Gizmi Shahmadi and these are our top stories this hour. The quake hit areas in Turkey and Syria. The death toll keeps rising. Over 33,000 people have so far been confirmed dead in the two countries. Officials say some 29,600 people have been killed in Turkey. At least hundreds have also lost their lives in the powerful earthquake. Rescue workers continue to scour neighborhoods despite the freezing weather. Experts, however, are cautioning that hopes of finding people alive are getting very slim. And the United States, the United Nations, that is, and the terrorist group in control of part of the quake-hit northern Syria are hampering the transfer of aid to the Syrian government. A spokesperson for the UN Human Rights Office says deliveries are held up over the approval issue of the terrorist group known as Hayat Tahrir al-Sham. Terrorists come as concerns are growing over the situation in the 3 days. The powerful earthquakes rocked the astonishingly the region in Turkey and Syria, and deaths from the injuries have been reported in the territory of the Persian group. Meanwhile, Martin Griffiths learned that the United Nations is not spending separately on aid missions to the quake-hit areas and in Syria. Griffiths also painted a grim picture of the situation there, Syria and Turkey, saying that the death toll is expected to double the amount. Our correspondent in Damascus, Mohammed Ali, joined us earlier for an update.
And we know that many countries have been trying to help Syria since this earthquake hit the country. Up till now, more than 60 airplanes coming from over 20 countries have landed in various Syrian airports loaded with humanitarian aid, on top of which, of course, those countries are Syria's allies and friends like Russia and Iran. Humanitarian aid is being distributed as much as soon as possible by the Syrian government, the Syrian Arab Red Crescent, and even NGOs and ordinary people have been trying to help as much as they can, exerting efforts, whether providing what they can with the food and medicine, or even trying to distribute alongside with the Syrian government and help those affected. However, more help is needed, but unfortunately, there are the sanctions on Syria by the United States and Western countries were not lifted. Nothing was probably offered from them, except for just yesterday, we heard that there were two airplanes coming from Italy that landed in Beirut, loaded with humanitarian aid for Syria. But search operations continue despite the fact that it has been 6 days and hopes are fading for finding anyone alive still over there. But dozens buildings have collapsed totally, creating this disastrous situation in Syria.
Moving on, yet another act of Israeli atrocities against Palestinians. The regime troops have shot dead a 14-year-old boy in the occupied West Bank. He was killed as Israeli troops conducted a raid on the flashpoint city of Jenin. Two other Palestinians were injured and are in the affection. Israeli forces regularly carry out deadly raids in the West Bank under the pretext of detaining Palestinians. The latest fatality comes as Palestinians were holding a funeral for a killed by the Israeli settler in the West Bank. Israel has stepped up its crackdown against Palestinians, killing nearly 50 people in the occupied West Bank since the beginning of the year. The U.S. military has shot down an unidentified flying object, this time over the Lake of Huron in the state of Michigan. This is the third object intercepted in the U.S. skies in the recent 3 days. The Pentagon spokesperson said the object traveling at an altitude of 20,000 feet was caught shot down by fighter jets upon a presidential order. Patrick Reuters says the object might have had surveillance activities as it was detected near sensitive military sites but posed no threat to them. The Canadian team has begun searching for the wreckage of the object that was shot down on Saturday. American authorities have not specified the details of the three objects on the radar. Recently, the U.S. also shot down what it called a Chinese spy balloon that had entered the American airspace. Beijing slammed the move as an unconstructive one, saying that the balloon was a civilian meteorological airship that had been blown off course. Brazil's former president, Jair Bolsonaro, says he intends to return home from the United States. The far-right politician faces accusations of inciting riots in the country following his defeat in the presidential election. We discuss this with our guests in our studio. Let's take a listen.
Time now for the news review. Brazil's former president Jair Bolsonaro, who is facing accusations of inciting riots in his country, says that he is going to go back home soon from his retreat in the U.S., the far-right politician saying that he'll be back in Brazil in the coming weeks. Bolsonaro left Brazil several days before his supporters stormed government buildings in the capital of Brasilia, while they tried to overturn the election victory of his rival Lula da Silva. Bolsonaro is under investigation in Brazil over his alleged role in the January 8th assault. He denies any responsibility, but Lula accuses him of orchestrating what he calls the coup. Washington has also been under pressure to extradite Bolsonaro. The riots in Brasilia have been compared to the 2021 assault on the U.S. Capitol by supporters of former American President Donald Trump. Time now to discuss this a little bit. So let me invite Camila Escalante, our correspondent, now in La Paz. Also with me is Isaac Biggio, Latin American expert, who is in London. Good to see you both. Let's go to Camila first. Tell us in the first place why Bolsonaro did not concede defeat in the election. Tell us why in the first place he left for the U.S. Why is he going back? He's facing charges back at home.
Absolutely. Well, he left in the final days of 2022 at the end of December, and it was on legal counsel that he decided. He was advised that he could be instantly arrested and jailed once the new government took power on January 1st. He didn't want to be part of the formal handing over of power to Lula, nor was his vice president a part of that. So he took off in those final days. He's been in Florida since. He arrived with a 30-day diplomatic visa, and we've heard a couple of things since then. On the one hand, he's been doing these speaking events in Florida since he's been there, and we've heard from people around him that he is still looking for a way to actually stay in the United States and extend his visa. At the same time, he's made the comment at some of his speaking events, including yesterday, that he will be looking to return to Brazil because his mission is not completed. That's what he said. And that he has, you know, some he's hinted or suggested that he has a movement to lead, a right wing movement to lead, because there's no leadership on the national level, although there is sort of subnational and regional leadership of, you know, these sort of pro-Bolsonaro political sectors. So it's unclear whether he will be able to successfully stay in the United States or if he really is coming or returning to Brazil. But it's important to note that in his final months as president in Brazil, he was kind of missing in action. He wasn't actually seen speaking to his base, holding public rallies, but he has this sort of audience that has been very receptive of him in the United States. So he kind of failed to lead his movement there, although it seems like he's very popular abroad right now. So, you know, it's very unclear what's going to happen, but it is the case that if he returns to Brazil, he will remain more politically relevant than if he's going to remain on the exterior, and that he does have a significant base that continues to support him. All of those millions of people who voted for him in the election that don't have a leadership or direction. So I think he's aware of that. And he also sees that there's no other or very few options for him on the exterior if he's going to try to, for example, seek asylum and run away from the potential charges that he'll be facing back in Brazil.
Okay. Isaac Bijou, how do you look at this? I mean, will he be in a better situation if he goes back to Brazil? And what do you expect President Lula to do in the judicial system in Brazil?
Well, I think at the moment Bolsonaro is playing, because sometimes he says that he's coming soon, sometimes his son or his lawyer said he applied for a six-month visa. So he's looking what's the best outcome for him. I agree with the other panelists, because he's more popular now in the States than in Brazil, because he's linked with Trump. If Trump backs, he's going to go for a trial. But on the other hand, I don't think the USA is going to give him asylum, because Joe Biden faced a similar coup to January's before than the coup that Bolsonaro did in Brazil. So my impression is that Bolsonaro will continue playing around while he sees what's the best situation for him. On the other hand, I don't believe that Joe Biden is going to be happy having Bolsonaro in the States, because he wants to be close with Lula. Albeit he can use Bolsonaro's situation to press Lula to be more pragmatic, more pro-USA, and more distant from the radical left in Latin America.
Okay. And Isaac, what do you see on the horizon as regards the U.S.-Brazil relationship now that President Lula is back in office?
Well, Lula is not a president that fight against the United States. It's not like Venezuela, Bolivia, Nicaragua, or Cuba. Mm-hmm. But he had some difference with the United States. For example, Brazil is more multipolar. He's more trying to make bridges with Russia, with India, with China. And Brazil is going to relaunch the Community of States of Latin America and the Caribbean, which has all, which united 33 countries out of the states, the South American Union of Nations, UNASUR, which is 12 countries, 12 republics in South America. And he's trying to create like a multipolar agenda. He had contradiction with the states regarding to Russia and Ukraine. Uh-huh. Albeit he criticized Russia for entering Ukraine, he's against arming Ukraine. So he's going to play a different role in international politics, and perhaps Biden is going to use Bolsonaro in the states to pressurize Lula to be more moderate or less radical, no? Already, Lula, for example, in the case of Peru, is the only Latin American progressive president that he's not condemning the coup d'etat in Peru, while, for example, Colombia is openly saying that the Peruvian police is acting like Nazis. He's trying to be conciliatory with the Peruvian coup, which is linked to the United States. So I think that Brazil is going to have a very moderate agenda, distant from the USA, but not radically in opposition to the United States.
Okay, we'll wait and see. Thank you so much for your contribution, Camila Escalante, our correspondent in La Paz, Isaac Bijou, Latin America expert in London.
Protests have been held across Italy against the national broadcaster's decision to read a message by the Ukrainian president during the country's biggest entertainment show of the year. Protesters have said the government must stop using public TV channels to promote aggressive rhetoric. Max Civilli reports.
On Saturday, protests were held in front of the Italian state broadcaster Rai's premises in a number of cities, including Rome, Milan and Naples. The protests had been called against the Rai's decision to read out a message by Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky during the final night of Italy's biggest entertainment TV show of the year, a song contest, which brings millions of viewers together.
Noi oggi siamo.
We are here today to remind our politicians the suffering we had to go through for decades after World War II. This man in the photo is my grandfather. He died during that war. We are against the bellicose propaganda broadcast on state TV.
Earlier this week, state broadcaster Rai opted to withdraw a planned video address by Zelensky at the popular TV show and replace it with the reading of a message sent by the Ukrainian leader.
I would have preferred Zelensky to have been present at the TV show. I've appreciated his decision to send a written message and, above all, I'm sorry about the controversy that was stirred up.
We say no to the politicization of culture, no to Zelensky on our TV shows, no to a man who is leading his country to destruction for a war that had been planned for years by the U.S.
The move by Rai to host Zelensky has inflamed the debate on the war in Ukraine in Italy, a country where support for Kyiv is more divided than elsewhere in Europe. Since the start of the conflict, surveys in Italy have showed that more than half of the Italians are against supplying Kyiv with more weapons. Many accuse Rai of providing information which is not impartial because the National Broadcaster's Board of Directors is directly linked to the government and the parliamentary majority. As a matter of fact, following a 2015 reform, 6 out of 7 Rai board directors are elected by the 2 houses of parliament and the government.
Italy's state broadcaster is now more than ever in the hands of the politicians. Rai and the government want Zelensky to appear on the television of millions of Italians to make them believe that this Ukraine war is a good war and that sending weapons to Kyiv is a good thing.
Italy's Prime Minister Meloni has repeatedly said that supporting Ukraine is the best way to reach a possible negotiated settlement with Moscow and that Rome aims to be a lead player in that regard and in Ukraine's reconstruction. Max Civilli, Rome.
And that brings us to the end of this edition of World News. Stay tuned.
Bustle of life. The sound of living. Only sound will endure.
Hello.
IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight. France has been hit by nationwide strikes as protesters voice their opposition to the proposed pension reforms. It is expected that the strikes will continue to impact daily life in France in the coming days. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. Truthout wrote in this regard, for the third time in less than a month, hundreds of thousands of workers across France participated in strikes and rallies to protest President Emmanuel Macron's unpopular plan to force people to work longer before they qualify for a full pension. The latest nationwide mobilization against Macron's assault on French retirement benefits brought at least 750,000 people to the streets, with turnout lower than on January 19th and January 31st. The recent walkouts and marches came one day after the National Assembly began debating legislation that would raise France's official retirement age from 62 to 64 by 2030. Rachel Keck, the first cleaner in France to become a lawmaker, said during a tense debate in Parliament recently, "Those of you who support this reform don't understand how tough jobs are, what it's like to wake up with aching back. You don't understand what it's like to take medication to get through the workday. You don't understand because it's not a world you live in." The leftists continued garnering applause from fellow opposition lawmakers. During a recent rally in the city of Nice, pensioner Bernard Chevalier echoed Keck, saying that "we are worn out by work." He said retirement should be a second life, not a waiting room for death. Opposition to pushing back France's retirement age is widespread, with recent polling showing that approximately 3/4 of the population is against such a move. Nevertheless, many of Macron's allies remain determined to fulfill his campaign pledge to overhaul the nation's pension system. Last week, Macron characterized his effort to hike the retirement age as essential, while Prime Minister Elizabeth Warren claimed that doing so is no longer negotiable. Recently, Labour Minister Olivier Dussopt dismissed opposition lawmakers' accusations that the government is in denial over the scale of protest and doubled down on the supposed need for change. Dussopt told RMC Radio, "The pension system is loss-making, and if we care about the system, we must save it." But as Agence France-Presse reported, some of the government's own experts have said the pension system is in relatively good shape and would likely eventually return to a balanced budget, even without reforms. Reuters reported union leaders and left-wing lawmakers meanwhile say the money can be found elsewhere, notably from the wealthy. Organized labor, for its part, intends to launch repeated waves of mass demonstrations until Macron and others who insist on the need to cut retirement benefits are defeated. Philippe Martinez, General Secretary of the General Confederation of Labor, CGT, said recently at a march in Paris, "This reform will upend the lives of several generations. If the government stubbornly forges ahead, we will step up our protest with longer and harder actions." Striking workers in strategic sectors, including electricity production, transportation, and education, disrupted multiple aspects of daily life recently, though to a lesser degree than they did twice last month. Macron's bill faces an uphill battle in the National Assembly. Notably, the new Ecological and Social People's Union, NUPES, a coalition of four left-wing parties recently formed by Jean-Luc Mélenchon, won 131 seats in last June's parliamentary elections, denying Macron's neoliberal alliance ensemble the absolute majority it needed to ram through his unwanted austerity agenda. However, journalist Marlon Ettinger, citing French Communist Party lawmaker André Cassigan, warned recently that the government might try to pass the reform through a social security financing bill known as PLFRSS, which would allow for a series of constitutional delays that would significantly limit the amount of time deputies can discuss the bill. It would also block the possibility for the opposition to present their own counterproposals. In addition, although Macron has no popular assent nor a parliamentary majority for his reform, he does have constitutional tools he can use to push the package through, Ettinger explained in Jacobin, adding one known as 49.3, after the article of the Constitution which grants the president this power, essentially lets him bypass the National Assembly. The Constitution of the current Fifth Republic grants the president these authoritarian powers to hedge against any popular sentiment that might make its way into the lower house. The use of 49.3 would suspend the debate in the National Assembly, then send the bill directly to the Senate, which is controlled by less Republicans. Laurent Berger, General Secretary of the French Democratic Confederation of Labour, CFDT, told a Parisian crowd recently that concessions offered by the government, such as allowing people who start working early to retire early, are just patches. Berger said increasing the legal retirement to 64 is the core of this reform and it is deeply unfair. It's a democratic folly for the government to turn a deaf ear to the protest. Another day of action is planned in the near future. Also, Reuters reported a national strike against planned pension reforms reduced France's power supply and disrupted petrol deliveries from French refineries recently. Strikes have been taking place since mid-January as unions protest against the government's plans to make people work longer before retirement. Public transport and schools have also been affected. Total power supply was reduced by about 6.3% or 4.3 gigawatts due to decreased supply at two nuclear reactors and several thermal and hydro plants, data from power utility EDF showed. Nuclear capacity was lowered by 1.8 gigawatts and thermal plants were reduced by 2.3 gigawatts, while hydropower disruption totaled 220 megawatts. No imports were needed at 2011 after peaking earlier at 2.8 gigawatts. Grid operator RTE data showed strike participation at EDF totaled some 30.3% of employees by midday, the utility said. This compares to the midday rate of 40.3% recorded on January 31st. On the refining side, the shipping of petrol products from French sites was interrupted by the strike, Total Energy said. The company added that there was no shortage of petrol at fueling stations and supply levels were generally satisfactory. About 56% of the operators working in the Total Energy's French refineries and depots were on a strike, the company said. At Esso, a subsidiary of ExxonMobil, about 75% of the workforce at the FAS site was on a strike and blocking deliveries while the Port Jerome site was operating, a CGT spokesperson said.
IRIB English Radio presents
Viewpoints.
Viewpoints.
With the presence of different scholars.
With the presence of different scholars. IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners. This is IRIB English Radio. You are listening to The Viewpoint. I'm Beta, the host of today's episode. And today with me, I have two dear guests, experts of today's episode. Assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
Brother, and assalamu alaikum, brother Muhammad.
Wa alaikum assalam. Thank you very much for having me once again.
Yeah, it's a pleasure for me to have you here with me. So as you know, throughout our history, we had the Islamic Revolution, which was an important event, which had a special role in everybody's life, actually. So, one of the goals of this revolution was independence of identity, which in today's discussion, we're going to go through that topic. I think we can see a lot of these signs of being independent from other countries and even after a lot of pressure. But the thing is, I think independence costs a lot. You know,
definitely.
The price of independence is so high.
Do you know why it costs a lot?
Also, if you want
cost. Very simple example. If you want to be the head of a tribe,
yeah.
So you have to pay too much because you need to entertain those who come to visit you, right? I don't want to meet the head of the region. No, scientifically, yes, this is our goal. We want to be the first and top country in the levels of knowledge and science, right?
Of course.
But if you want to be the big person in your tribe, you have to pay even for those who come to you to visit you, to entertain them and to have to provide them with facilities, right?
Yeah, exactly. So, mm-hmm. Brother Muhammad, what do you think about this matter of the cost of independence?
Let's look at the history rather to understand the cost that we have to give. I'm looking at independence in a more abstract, not necessarily the specific to the independence of the Islamic Revolution, though that's, I think, the most idealistic independence that we can find in the world. But consider the independence that we had from the colonial rule of the British and the other European warheads. Look in South America, for example. Caribbean was mainly ruled by the British, but what cost did they have to give for them to be independent from the British? Now, when I mean ruled, meaning that everything from culture, education, economy, to their even lives, because they were considered slaves over there. Look at India, for example, or South Africa. People like Mahatma Gandhi and Nelson Mandela had to take a great step, be imprisoned, whipped, even penalized, sometimes by their own people, in some situations, just so that they can find this independence, or rather, I should say, relative independence from the people who are making their decisions. Like I mentioned, the first thing that comes to my mind when I talk about independence in relation when it's opposite of freedom is you making your own decisions. Now, countries who have gone through this are able to make decisions at least relatively better. But still, if you look at the different dimensions of the society, their societies, for example, let's say India, right? Now, where does this education system in India come from? Is it independent? Do they make their own decisions? No.
No, of course not.
Unfortunately. But what about, for example, their economy? Again, more than 50% of the world's economy is dependent on the US dollars. Why? Why is that so? Whenever there is recession, the global recession, it has to come back to the US dollars. Why does every country have to make transactions based on US dollars? That's economic independence.
Yeah.
So when the U.S. is deteriorating when it comes to their economy, the entire world has to face that same deterioration.
Thank you. So you told me about, political and economical independence. But the thing now I'm going to go through is the cultural independence. Mm-hmm. The thing I'm really curious about this domain is that is it really too good to have cultural independence? I mean, isn't it dangerous to have cultural independence? Because we have to have cultural interaction with other countries and societies.
Mm-hmm.
So is there any danger in being that much independent in a cultural part or not?
No, there is. The thing is, independence, again, does not mean that you don't have relationships with other cultures or other countries. Rather, it's actually a good thing when you are making your own decision out of your own voluntary move. You make relation with another country, with another culture. There is no problem in that. Even learning from other cultures, the goods and bads, you know, learning the bads from the cultures, trying to improve yours, and learning the good and trying to bring it into your own culture is not a problem, right? This is how the human fabric, the cultural fabric of life kind of, you know, entangles between each other. You'll find so many things out throughout the history that were kind of loaned and, you know, debted to different cultures. You'd find so many foods coming in from India to Iran and from Iran to India, just because of sometimes trade and the relations that we have. There is no problem in that. The problem arises when one wants to enforce one thing in some other culture because he sees it more superior to the others. That's the problem that we have.
But I think the problem is, you know, is not that much visible in a modern world because,
exactly.
You know, for example, we are living here, and if somebody comes and tell you to change into your culture, you won't accept it. You know, they do it so delicately that you cannot understand that you are being defeated by other people's culture.
Yeah, that is,
you know,
that.
What I mean, it's happening unconsciously.
Exactly. The Nixon, the ex-president of the United States, he wrote a book about conquering the world without soldiers. And in the introduction of that book, he mentions why he wrote that book. He said that how they had to pay so much of, cost for the liberations, quote-unquote, that they went through in Vietnam and in Japan and, for example, let's say Iraq and so on, right? And instead of giving blood, their soldiers' blood, it's easier to give cost, you know, and invest in media in trying to kind of enslave the minds of the world into the cultural fabric of the United States.
Yeah.
And that's why you find societies that have a very strong U.S. media presence. You'd find them insecure of their own culture, and they want to be as much, they want to mimic as much as they can to the culture
exactly.
that is being shown in the media. And that is one of the biggest dangerous aspects of it. And you mentioned about how this cultural attack is so unseen. That is how it works out. For media, they don't tell you directly, okay, this is our culture, our culture is more superior, take this now. That's how it works. They move you from step by step, one step at a time. Like, for example, they saw in terms of economic benefit, after the Industrial Revolution, making this movement of feminism, making things equal between man and woman, right, in all aspects of their lives, right, was profitable for the economic lords. Now what they saw is, so the best thing to do is make the entire world be like this.
Yeah, exactly.
The new world order. Just bring the man and the woman in the same level in the society. Let them do the work. The industrial mechanism of the society is moving, but what about the family mechanism? We look at the recent incidents that happened in Qatar. You'd find so many, you know, LGBTQ, whatever it is, they have so many long initials, right?
Yeah.
Their movement, they had a very strong presence there, and they tried their best to, you know, put themselves out. Look at, for example, you know, but then it backlashed against them. People who were in Qatar, they realized, oh, look, this is a different culture. Respect it. Let them be independent. Let them make their own decisions. Why do you have to? That's my question. Why do you have to bring in things that the people socially don't accept, and you have to enforce that in the society? Let them be independent. Let them make their own choices.
Yeah. You know what? The thing is, you know, as you told me, there should be a kind of connection between this independence and freedom. You know, and I think sometimes we confuse these two with each other, especially in the cultural context. So, what do you think, Brother Ali, about this issue?
Yeah, actually, I want to say that cultural dependence has some factors, and we have to clarify the factors to see how. I mean, in case we studied it well, and we can understand what is the opposite side, so that we cope with it. Usually, dominant cultures are apt to actually conquer the other cultures and to actually remove and try to digest them inside themselves. That's why, for example, West is trying to make his own culture, its own culture, dominant culture.
Yeah.
What is our duty? We have to know, we have to understand what are the elements and factors of cultural dependence. One of the factors which is very important is the kind of ontology that we have towards this world. Actually, in case we know the world well and we have understood it well and we learned about it well, then with a tawhidi ontology, we can cope with it very, much more better. Then knowing about the elements of, let's say, Islamic upbringing, the upbringing itself, because it's, again, a sort of, let's say, element which is very influential in conquering the culture of the other culture, conquering the other cultures. So in knowing what Islam says in this regard actually can give us and can help us to understand what Islam has in this regard. Another element or factor which is very important is self-confidence. Mm-hmm. To reach this self-confidence that we are able to do whatever we are after. So thinking that, okay, since we have been behind for, let's say, more than centuries, 10 centuries, we cannot go back to this world and we cannot provide the worldly affairs of the people. So we have to actually, like any other country, we have to go and live very submissively with the superpowers. So it's not the case. In case we have a good worldview and then we have understood our religion and our, let's say, whatever we have, our treasure as well, then we can cope with the other culture very well. So we can stop in front of them. And we have to understand this point that, again, like every other show that I repeat this point, that Allah's promises are true. We should not see that, okay, we are few in number, but on the other side is very large and huge.
Yeah.
We should not be scared of that, because Allah says, "Kam min fatin qalil ghalabat fatin kathira," and we have seen this promise had happened, I mean, at the time of Battle of Badr, right? Number of Muslims, how many were there in number, and how many were the infidels in the other side?
Exactly.
So in case we say, okay, we are only one country standing in front of this dominant culture and we have to just raise our hands up, so it's not the case. Because we have this rich culture coming from Islam, the enlightening Islam and the culture of the Ahl al-Bayt, so there is no way for us to get it dependent on any other culture. So I think other cultures should come and sit to learn what Islam says.
Yeah.
So we are sure that we have that rich info that we can even feed any other culture. So we have to be careful and we have to actually vaccinate our younger generation to know only, this is the minimum thing that we can do, mm-hmm. to know what they have. In case they know that what they have, I think that would be perfect for them. Unfortunately, due to the pressures that were on us in the last two centuries, this self of being humiliated has been actually imposed in some of us, and we think that we are not able to cope with this
exactly.
culture. What we do, what we can, and inshallah we'll do.
Inshallah, thank you for your elaboration, and thank you, Brother Muhammad, for being here in this episode. Actually, we got to know that actually we have a lot of accomplishment in these different fields of independence, and also we essay to have more independence in different aspects of being independent. Like, I don't know, especially cultural one, which is so important. We have to use, the threat of freedom that they give us to show our own cultural independence in that area of freedom. Mm-hmm. So, inshallah, thank you, dear listeners, for listening to us. And this is all the time we had for today's episode. I leave you in the warm embrace of God. And assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Shining bright, you came to us with a heart so full of love, and you showed that you're the one who cares the most, and to us you've always been so. so close, everyone will say, please save me, except Al-Habib. Ummati, Ummati, يقولها لنا يوم القيامة. أمتي أمتي يقولها شفاعة أنا لها أنا لها.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/parstodayen. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/parstodayenglish.
In the limelight.
Every human being gets outraged by the reckless slaughter of innocent people in U.S. endless wars ranging from Vietnam to Afghanistan. Actually, weapons manufacturers profiting from these endless wars should be held accountable for criminal activity. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. The website of Common Dreams wrote in this regard, days after a U.S. warplane bombed Doctors Without Borders Médecins Sans Frontières MSF hospital in Kunduz, Afghanistan, killing 42 people, 24 of them patients, the international president of MSF, Dr. Jean Leo, walked through the wreckage and prepared to deliver condolences to family members of those who had been killed. A brief radio, taped in October 2015, captures her nearly unutterable sadness as she speaks about a family who, the day before the bombing, had been prepared to bring their daughter home. Doctors had helped the young girl recover, but because war was raging outside the hospital, administrators recommended that the family come the next day. They said, "She's safer here." The child was among those killed by the U.S. attacks, which recurred at 15-minute intervals for an hour and a half, even though MSF had already issued desperate pleas begging the United States and NATO to stop bombing the hospital. Dr. Leo's sad observations seemed to echo in the words of people lamenting war's afflictions. People speak about peace. The United Nations has done everything possible, but they have not succeeded. Then activists gathered at a Pentagon-held signs decrying the slaughter of innocents in our time. They protested the obscenely bloated military budget which the U.S. Congress just passed as a part of Consolidated Appropriations Act of 2023. As Norman Stockwell of The Progressive recently noted, the bill contains nearly $1.7 trillion of funding for FY 2023, but of that money, $858 billion is earmarked for the military defense spending and an additional $45 billion in emergency assistance to Ukraine and NATO allies. This means that more than half, that is $900 billion out of $1.7 trillion, is not being used for non-defense discretionary programs. And even that lesser portion includes $118.7 billion for funding of the Veterans Administration and other military-related expense. By depleting funds desperately needed to meet human needs, the U.S. defense budget doesn't defend people from pandemics, ecological collapse, and infrastructure decay. Instead, it continues a deranged investment in militarism. Phil Berrigan's prophetic in Transigency, resisting all wars and weapons manufacturing is needed now more than ever. Everybody is outraged by the reckless slaughter of innocent people in endless wars by the U.S., ranging from Vietnam to Afghanistan, with weapons manufacturers profiting from these endless wars, and they should be held accountable for criminal activity. The weapons corporations rob people worldwide of the capacity to meet basic human needs. The appallingly greedy Pentagon budget represents a corporate takeover of the U.S. Congress. As the coffers of weapons manufacturers swell, these military contractors hire legions of highly paid lobbyists tasked with persuading elected officials to earmark even more funds for companies like Lockheed Martin, Boeing, Raytheon United, and General Atomics. According to military, stockpiles of weapons must be used up in order to justify more weapons manufacturing. Media complicity is necessary and can be purchased in order to frighten U.S. taxpayers into the continued bankrolling of what could become worldwide annihilation. Phil Berrigan, who in his lifetime evolved from soldier to scholar to prophetic anti-nuclear activist, astutely linked the racial oppression he opposed as a civil rights activist to the rising oppression caused by militarism. He likened racial injustice to a terrible hydra that contrives a new face for every area of the world. Throughout his life, Phil Berrigan identified with people menaced by the Hydra's new faces of war, elaborating on this theme in a book called No More Strangers, published in 1965, he wrote that the dispassionate decision of people in the United States to practice racial discrimination made it not only easy but logical to enlarge our oppressions in the form of international nuclear threats. How can people in the United States prevent the killing that goes on in multiple wars exacerbated by weapons made in the USA? One step they can take involves both political and humanitarian efforts to hold accountable the corporations profiting from the U.S. military budget. Drawing on Phil Berrigan's steadfastness, activists worldwide are planning the Merchants of Death War Crimes Tribunal, scheduled to be held on November 10th to 13th, 2023. The tribunal intends to collect evidence about crimes against humanity committed by those who develop, store, sell, and use weapons to commit crimes against humanity. Testimony is being sought from people who have borne the brunt of modern wars, the survivors of wars in Afghanistan, Iraq, Yemen, Gaza, and Somalia, to name but a few of the places where U.S. weapons have terrified people who have meant them no harm. We render you, corporations obsessed with war, profiteering, accountable, answerable, declares the Reverend Dr. Cornel West on the tribunal's website. On November 10, 2022, organizers of the Merchants of Death War Crimes Tribunal and their supporters served a subpoena to directors and corporate offices of weapons manufacturers Lockheed Martin, Boeing, Raytheon United, and General Atomics. The subpoena will expire on February 10, 2023. It compels them to provide to the tribunal all documents revealing their complicity in aiding and abetting the U.S. government in committing war crimes, crimes against humanity, bribery, and theft. People menaced by the Hydra's new faces of war often have nowhere to flee, nowhere to hide. Thousands upon thousands of the victims are children. Mindful of the children who are maimed, traumatized, displaced, orphaned, and killed by all of the wars raging today, they must hold themselves accountable as well. Humanity literally cannot live in complicity with the patterns that lead to bombing hospitals and slaughtering children.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.